on WIPR, we're on the record. I'm Sheila Cass. Good morning. Dr. Peter V. Rabens has been studying the brain, and dementia in particular, for a half century, since before most Americans had heard of Alzheimer's disease. He founded and directed the Division of Geriatric Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Over the decades, patients have asked him thousands of questions about how memory works, what dementia is, and what might stave it off, and how to help someone they love. The questions he's asked most often, he's collected into a short book called Is It Alzheimer's? 101 Answers to Your Most Pressing Questions About Memory Loss and Dementia. Now Dr. Rabens has updated 101 Answers and joins us by Zoom to talk about it. Welcome to On the Record.
Thank you, Sheila. Thanks for having me.
You describe telling a patient you're concerned about their memory and want to talk to them about it. But dementia is more than memory, right?
Yes, and that's actually a key point, that dementia involves multiple different aspects of thinking or cognition. So if it's Alzheimer's, it's usually memory impairment plus thinking difficulties and other aspects of how we interact with everyone.
Is that how Alzheimer's disease is defined?
My definition, let's say, is that it requires at least two different aspects of cognition. People are struggling in the official diagnoses and definitions, but I think to say it requires at least two aspects of thinking makes it different from other things and is a useful way to think about a definition.
What other kinds of thinking problems play into whether or not someone has dementia?
Every aspect of thinking can be impaired by dementia. Now, different diseases affect different aspects of thinking early. But in addition to memory, people develop problems in judgment, in making abstractions so they can't interpret what's happening in the world. Their ability to use numbers and understand them declines. One of the really difficult symptoms is difficulty communicating with language, so language impairment. And I think many listeners will probably have known someone who's developed an aphasia, the medical term for language impairment, after a stroke. And it turns out that in Alzheimer's disease, people develop exactly the same kinds of language impairments. The difference is it sneaks up very slowly. And so often people haven't realized that the person with the disease is not able to communicate, either not able to understand what's being said to them or not be able to express what they want to say. So that's one of the more challenging cognitive symptoms of dementia.
Question 2 of 101 in your book, quote, I'm having trouble remembering the names of friends and family members and difficulty coming up with the words I want to say. Should I worry? Close quote.
The answer to that is not necessarily. If it's not interfering with your life in any way, and if usually those words or names come to you after a few seconds or even a minute or two, you probably have normal aging changes. However, if it is starting to interfere with your everyday function, or if the words and names never come back to you, you should see a specialist to be evaluated.
What is the diagnosis, mild cognitive impairment, MCI?
That's a relatively new term, and I think it's been a big advance in the field. Alzheimer's disease and many of the other causes of dementia develop very gradually. So people move from having normal thinking and cognition to becoming impaired. And the question has been for a long time, well, how does that start? People have been focusing on the definition of that for about 20 years. And we now have good criteria for identifying people who are having trouble more than would be associated with usual aging, but hasn't really interfered with their life yet. So it's a little worse than normal aging changes, but not definitely impairing everyday activity.
And does MCI always lead to dementia?
Actually, it doesn't. And it's a useful category in that way. First, about 25% of people a year later become normal. And so that means at least for that group, they were having a bad day. They might have had a cold. They might have been on medication. Maybe they didn't sleep the night before. But if you take the other 75%, about 10% of those people every year afterward develop dementia. So it is often the beginning of dementia, but not necessarily Alzheimer's. There are many other causes of dementia as well.
A deficit you describe in several of your 101 answers is agnosia. And most of us are more familiar with the adjective agnostic than we are with the noun. What is agnosia and how does it show up?
It means to not recognize or not know. And so there are different aspects of vision that this often occurs in. So sometimes people lose the ability to recognize a person from their face. So an agnosia for faces. They may know everything about the person, but when they look at them, they cannot match what their vision is seeing with what their knowledge is. Other people develop this for things like their house or other common objects. So it's an inability to recognize a familiar object or thing.
And you talk about how, for example, somebody might be looking at a toilet but not recognize it.
Yes, and it's hard to understand or believe that that can happen when they seem to find their way around the house or the room. But that is the essence of this symptom, and it is a symptom of several dementias, including Alzheimer's disease.
Well, I think what struck me most at a place when you were describing agnosia is that the failure to recognize something you're looking at is not just a complication if you don't recognize that there's more than one food on your plate, that it means a person can never know they're in a familiar place.
Yes, and I think that's why it's one of the most devastating symptoms, both for the person with the disease and for their loved ones. From the loved one's point of view, it means a person no longer knows with their vision that you're their spouse, their daughter, their child. And that is very devastating for the recipient of that. And for the person, what it means is, as you said, nothing looks familiar to them. And I can only imagine, because it's hard for people with the disease to put this in words, but as you said, I think it means that they can never be in a familiar place. Nothing ever looks familiar. And I think this is one of the reasons that many people wander about with these diseases. They're so distressed because they feel constantly lost.
This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Dr. Peter Rabens, author of the newly updated book, Is It Alzheimer's? The book was first published 5 years ago, and Dr. Rabens, one of the reasons you've updated it is the new drugs that have been developed. What's now available?
Yes, I think this is one of the great advances and very exciting in a way. There are two approved medications now that remove one of the abnormal proteins that gets deposited in the brains of people with Alzheimer's disease. There are two of these proteins. One is called tau and one is called amyloid beta. And the drugs that have been approved actually remove about 90% of this amyloid beta from the brain. So that's a huge advance. At least so far, the benefits from the drugs are pretty modest, though, only about 7% above a sugar pill or placebo. So they're not dramatic improvements yet, but I think it's the first step in what I believe will be an exciting way to pharmacologically address the disease.
And there are other drugs that people take that are prescribed that you say once you stop taking the drug, you go back to where you were in the decline of cognition.
Yeah, so these other drugs have been around for more than 30 years. What they do is affect some of the chemicals in the brain that are related either to memory or to the destruction of cells, but they don't directly address what's causing the disease. And again, we don't know that these abnormal proteins are the ultimate cause, but these other drugs that have been available called donepezil is the most commonly used one. These do help a little bit overall, but again, they don't change the biology. So the disease progresses at the same rate, whether you take it or not, but there's a slight improvement. So when you stop the drug, you go right back to where you would have been if you'd never taken it.
You also point out new ways that Alzheimer's is diagnosed.
Yes, this is one of the new, really exciting advances. For most of my career, the diagnosis is purely clinical, which means a doctor would take a history from the patient and the family, would do a physical examination, would draw blood, would test their memory, ask about depression, other questions like that. And once all those results were back, would make a diagnosis of dementia first and then ask what it's caused by, Alzheimer's disease, Parkinson's disease with dementia, there are other diseases. So it was the doctor's opinion based on all the information that the doctor had gathered. But in the last 7 or 8 years, there have been big advances, first in brain scans. Now, typical CAT scans or MRI scans, which many people know about, show a picture of the brain, but not how it's working. But there are now scans called PET scans that can be used to measure how much of the abnormal proteins that cause or are related to Alzheimer's disease actually are in the brain. And so there are PET scans for the amyloid beta protein and PET scans for the tau protein. So far, the FDA has approved the PET scans for amyloid. And so if a person has both difficulty in thinking and a positive PET scan showing this amyloid protein, that is now used to make a diagnosis. There are also spinal fluid tests. Now, most people are not going to undergo that, but those also seem to be very accurate. And very recently, the FDA has approved a blood test that measures the ratio, how much of the tau and amyloid proteins there are in the blood. And again, it requires the person have both symptoms of the disease of dementia, meaning thinking impairment, and a positive blood test. So that's important because the treatments that are being developed now have a lot of side effects, and we would not want to expose anybody to them who was misdiagnosed. So this is going to be a dramatically different diagnostic process going forward.
But when we're talking about a disease that many people don't want to know they have, will people actually seek out early diagnosis?
I think that's a great question. I think the hope is that if we develop more and more effective treatments, that resistance will either disappear or at least diminish, or we'll be able to explain to people the benefits of getting a diagnosis. One of the challenges is that Alzheimer's disease itself seems to block awareness. So it's not a totally meaningful decision, I don't want to know. Many people don't experience the memory loss and other thinking impairments. So they don't know there's a problem. And when somebody tells them that, they can't see it. But the hope is that if we have tests, people will at least be willing to go ahead and see whether the test shows they have a problem.
That's Dr. Peter Rabens, retired Johns Hopkins professor of psychiatry. We're talking about his newly updated book, Is It Alzheimer's? 101 Answers to Your Most Pressing Questions About Memory Loss and Dementia. Short break on the record. When we're back, caring for people with Alzheimer's and the quality of life patients can expect. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. New research indicates the risk of developing dementia is greater than we used to think. Perhaps 1 in 5 people by age 75, higher after age 85. Dr. Peter Rabens, founding director of the Division of Geriatric Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, has updated his book, Is It Alzheimer's?, a compilation of the questions he is asked most about dementia. It grows out of the famous Bible of Guidance for Caregivers that he and Nancy Mace published in 1981, The 36-Hour Day. That book is also being updated, 7th edition, later this year. Dr. Rabens, as you describe different challenges caregivers face, you mentioned the importance of a trial and error approach. Describe that.
Well, many of the symptoms that families observe and that people with the disease experience manifest as changes in their behavior, their personality. They may become withdrawn, they may become aggressive, may become suspicious. And so we're not only trying to improve people's thinking and cognition, and we do that both with medication and by adapting the environment to their needs, but these other behavioral, or they're also called neuropsychiatric symptoms, are what we try to manage from day to day. And there are a whole variety of approaches to these different symptoms. Say if you take suspiciousness or paranoia, there are many things you can try, but there's no way to really know in advance what's going to work for any individual person. So one of the ways we actually put the 36-hour day together was to talk with lots of patients and their families and find out what they had tried and then compile those in the book. And so you might try one thing that doesn't work. You might try a second approach that may not work, but maybe number three or four will help. So keeping an open mind, not becoming overly discouraged, and trying new things hopefully resolves most of these other symptoms.
Why are women at greater risk for dementia than men?
We really don't know. I think it's a great question. For many years, people thought really the sexes had an equal distribution. It's just that women live longer, and age is the strongest risk factor for developing Alzheimer's disease and dementia. But now we know that being a woman does place people at increased risk no matter what the age. So if you look at 70-year-olds, there are a greater percentage of women. And if you look at 80 and 90, that seems to hold up as well. People have speculated for a long time that perhaps this is related to the hormonal changes that occur with menopause, because the estrogens and the related compounds drop significantly in women and don't in men. And it's thought that there might be some protection there. And in fact, elderly men have higher levels of estrogen than women of the same age. So that's one of the things people speculate about, but it's really not known yet.
What, if anything, can people do to prevent Alzheimer's?
That's another exciting area of research, and there have really been a lot of advances in the last few years. Probably the single biggest thing that we can do now to prevent it is to make sure that if we have blood pressure in midlife, we get it treated. So treating high blood pressure throughout life is important, but it seems like high blood pressure in midlife in people's 40s and 50s is one of the biggest predictors of eventually developing Alzheimer's disease. Another one that's hard to prove, but the evidence seems to be very strong, is that staying physically and mentally active seems to stave off the disease. And of course, this is true for heart attack and stroke as well. So it's a kind of a win-win-win. And the CDC recommends 30 minutes a day, 5 days a week of exercise. And I think that's a good target. Another thing that I think is fairly well established, although again, really hard to ultimately prove, is that eating a Mediterranean-like diet seems to be associated with a lower risk. So less red meat, more vegetables, nuts, fruits, grains, also seem to be associated with a lower risk.
Are people with dementia more prone to depression?
Yes. And it's a tricky relationship. It looks like people who develop depression for the first time in later life, say after age 60, are at increased risk of developing dementia. So it may really be that in those people, the depression was the very first sign of dementia, even though the memory and other thinking problems haven't developed for 10 or 15 years. But if we just look at people who have dementia, and interestingly enough, the severity of the depression and the frequency of it seems to be unrelated to how severe the dementia or cognitive impairment or movement problems are. So it probably, at least in large part, comes from the fact that the brain is where our mood is located, and that brain diseases can trigger depression, particularly clinical depression, the same way that depression just comes up spontaneously in other people.
This is On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast, speaking with Dr. Peter Rabens, author of Is It Alzheimer's? 101 Answers to Your Most Pressing Questions About Memory Loss and Dementia. Several of those answers deal with how caregivers can know what the person with dementia is feeling.
Yes, and one of the challenges of having memory trouble is that it's harder to report to people what you're experiencing because you don't remember that your arm hurt 10 or 15 seconds or minutes ago. And you don't really realize that you're much sadder than you usually are. So we often have to rely on observers, particularly loved ones who know a person well, to say they appear sadder than usual. They're crying when they normally wouldn't do that. They're more withdrawn than usual. They're less active. So for both pain and depression, we often have to rely on other people. If they're in a long-term care facility, it may be the nursing assistants who get to know them pretty well. But it's usually family members who notice these changes.
One thing that happens, I gather, quite commonly in late-stage Alzheimer's is people have difficulty swallowing, and that can lead to much more than just discomfort.
Yeah, absolutely. People now say, and I think it's accurate, that Alzheimer's disease and dementia, they are the fifth or sixth most common cause of death. And when people say, well, how does that happen? About half of people with dementia, whatever the cause, die from pneumonia. And we believe that the cause of the pneumonia is most commonly either body secretions from the mouth and the nose going into the lungs, food going into the lungs, either from the stomach or because swallowing is impaired. So all of us are secreting things in our mouth and our nose all the time, and we don't even know that we're just swallowing it and it goes into our stomach. But as swallowing becomes impaired, whether it's from a stroke or Alzheimer's disease or some other neurologic illness, when those things go into the lungs, they can cause a chemical pneumonia, and they increase the risk of developing infectious diseases that cause pneumonia. So that's very common in the late stages of these diseases.
I heard you say that people with dementia can experience a positive quality of life even when the disease is severe. I can't imagine that. In fact, I can't think of anything worse than knowing you have Alzheimer's disease. Close quote. To which, Dr. Rabens, you say?
I say first, I've heard that from many people who are cognitively normal, and I don't want to downplay what a horrible disease it is and how difficult and bad it is both for the person and their loved ones. But on the other hand, many people with dementia live in the moment. Unfortunately, they've sort of lost their past. They've sort of lost the future. But in the moment, they're interacting with people. They're doing things they enjoy. They can smile, laugh. And so one of the things I've done in my career is try to measure quality of life in people with Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. And one of the things we found is that the severity of the dementia very weakly correlates with a lowered quality of life. So many people can enjoy pleasure, and our job as care providers, whether it's professional or family members, loved ones or friends, is to interact with the person at their level, talk about things that they enjoy, and just treat them as a friend, as a loved one. And that still brings pleasure to them, even though, again, we realize what a horrible disease it is.
Dr. Rabens, thank you for talking about this, and thanks for the book.
Oh, you're welcome, and thanks for having me, Sheila.
Dr. Peter V. Rabens, founding director of the Division of Geriatric Psychiatry at Johns Hopkins, now retired, has updated his book, Is It Alzheimer's? 101 Answers to Your Most Pressing Questions About Memory Loss and Dementia. At the On the Record page at WYPR.org, we've got links to information about it and the book he co-wrote with Nancy Mace, The 36-Hour Day. I'm Sheila Cast. Glad you're with us on the record. Join us again Friday.